You are listening to The After Chat with me, Pollyanna. 18 and older, please proceed and enjoy. Under 18, listen no further. Now, as you know, this is the show after the show where we include your incredible insights, questions. We get it all out here. I love this show, actually, and you all have seemed to really respond really well to it, too. I get to see all the numbers as they come in. And so this is definitely, of everything that I've done, the most popular by far. And I think that's great because it makes it so much more personal, so much more about you, which for me is what I've always wanted to do from the start. So you may remember a couple after chats ago, we had a question come in about a woman who was dating a man and they have a great relationship. She's considering polyamory. She's bisexual, but wanted to know about bringing it up to him. And we talked about that, you know, it's really important to, as you're just first thinking about it, to cue in your partner. Now, if it's a fleeting thought and you're not very serious about it, you know, maybe bogging down your partner with every little thing that comes into your mind all the time might be a little bit exhausting, but it's something that she was considering seriously. And so we talked about that. We talked about communication, transparency, how this was really the first step for her to experience what communication and what approaching new ideas in relationship is like for polyamorous couples or for polyamorous triads, pods, and that this would really be a great beginning of that journey if she were to go down that road. So I got an update from her and I wanted to share it all with you with her blessing. So she reached out and said, "Hey, Pollyanna, I just wanted to say thank you again for the support and advice. I was able to talk to my boyfriend and discuss what's been on my mind. And I was able to discuss and to follow the advice that you gave me. He was understandably a little hesitant, but 100% supportive. And we decided to just take things slow and see how things go for now." And so I responded to her and I said, "No rush for the things that are truly worth it. I'm so glad and not at all surprised based on what you said, described before, how supportive he was. Seeing how things go and growing is honestly my favorite part about dating someone new who's open to polyamory. Savor every moment." And then I asked her to keep up with her amazing communication transparency, that she's already well on her way. You're already well on your way to approaching polyamory exactly as you should, and maintain it and how you maintain it once you're there, with care and cherishing the love you already share with him, with your partner. And so we said our goodbyes after that, but that's absolutely so true. And I think I've mentioned it before, you know, when you bring up polyamory or it comes up with somebody that you're considering dating or that you are dating, if you're kind of at the onset of it, it's really something that especially if you're bringing it up to them, it's such a big change or it's such a big departure from relationship dynamics that you've probably shared with them in the past. And so it makes sense that they're not going to be immediately on board and like, yeah, oh my gosh, let's jump into it from minute one, right? That's just not, that's an unrealistic expectation. It's something that's a huge paradigm shift for a lot of people. So we need to give our loved ones room to really ruminate on it, think about it, feel it out in their mind, kind of, you know, try it out in their head first and continue these conversations. And what I find is a lot of the time people usually do grow into also desiring it, you know, if it's genuinely right for them. You know, when we grow up with these constructs in our mind of how relationships are supposed to work and we're already in a good relationship and we kind of have are thrown for a loop a little bit, it makes sense that we're not going to be immediately like, oh my gosh, yes, you just completely changed everything I thought about things, but yeah, I want to do it right away. No, that's not that we need to be patient with our loved ones to grow, right? If we're bringing it up to them. So this is definitely a natural reaction that I think her boyfriend is having. And I think it's very loving the way she's describing that he's responded to be open to it, but not rushing into it, which is advice I think I probably gave her, which I give all the time is ease into it with your partner, especially if it's new to them. Work on education together, begin those discussions, get specific though, talk about, okay, because how many people, you know, how are we going to approach this when we get there? How are we going to talk about it? What are our norms? So there's this really cool type of relationship philosophy that was recently introduced to me. I'm learning something new every day, especially with polyamory. It's very complex and it's always evolving, it seems like. But this concept is called relationship anarchy. And I thought it was so cool, actually. So it's basically saying, there's some polyamorous people that are this way. It's kind of almost the opposite of relationship hierarchy in some ways, though I think that's a gross oversimplification. So relationship anarchy is saying, okay, we're coming together, we're drawn together, but we're going to have a relationship completely ignoring everything we know about relationships before now. And we're going to build it from scratch with new pieces as if it's being built for the first time, completely our way as we're called to from within. And I think that's a really, really cool way to approach relationships. And I think it's a great kind of lesson too. And even if you're not necessarily of the relationship anarchy mindset, and I'll see if I can find a link to include in the details that will describe relationship anarchy to you if you're a little bit more interested in learning more. But it's really kind of a cool way of really embracing thinking outside of the box, which is what polyamory is within itself, within its nature, kind of to begin with, right? It's a departure from monogamy, which is what we've, you know, socially accepted for so long. And so to go completely in a different direction, it makes sense that relationship anarchy really fits in with polyamory for a lot of people. And certainly, I think a lot of the concepts of relationship anarchy across the board are really, really fitting for us to learn more about and consider and be inspired by, for sure. So I'm so glad to hear back from you. Thank you so much for the update. I can't wait for more updates from you in the future. I'm sending so much love and I'm so excited for you that things went so well. You never know. You know, when somebody comes to you at the beginning of this, you know, I haven't, you know, had any exchanges with her boyfriend, just kind of based on, you know, what she's shared. I just had kind of a vibe and hope for the best, but it really, really warms my heart to know how open and receptive he was to talking about it and considering with you, and what a loving, loving thing for him to do. So best of luck to you. Please do keep us updated. We're very excited to know how things go from here. So I thought it appropriate today to segue in from, you know, a kind of somebody at the onset of polyamory and considering it to somebody who's maybe been, or who's definitely been in polyamory for a while. So as I mentioned in the past, I'm a group, a member of many groups on Facebook, primarily of polyamory people connected primarily within the United States. But a lot of folks will post, you know, like a post of like, hey, kind of advertising themselves, almost like a classified ad. But a lot of the times there's these really insightful, thoughtful conversations that happen. And so I wanted to bring up one that came up the other day that I thought was really kind of a cool perspective that I did actually end up responding to. So a woman posted in one of these forums, when I think back to my first, in parentheses, accidentally poly relationship, I remember it being very authentic. Now, the older I get, it feels more and more inauthentic. It feels like instead of falling head over heels in love, we cautiously conduct a pass, in parentheses, or don't pass, interviews. It feels like shopping for the right qualities and getting to sell yourselves. Or yours. It doesn't feel very good. What happened to that craziness and free-spiritedness of those early years in polyamory? And when did we just start looking for somebody that fits our, air quotes, standards? I know we've been hurt and have become more careful, and that's a good thing, but we've also learned what works for us and doesn't work. We know ourselves and our needs, which is also good. I guess my question is, where do we draw the line between true connection and shopping? I'm just going to say this now. It's not my intention to hurt anyone's feelings. I'm just venting about the stuff I happen to encounter and observe. I'm very, very sensitive to authenticity. So it might not feel to you the same way it does to me. Plus, your life experience might be very different. That being said, I would love to know everyone's thoughts on this. So I completely relate to this. I'm very sensitive to authenticity myself. And what that means for me is that if I feel like somebody's putting on a front or faking it, I'm turned off. And I don't care how imperfect and dorky you are. I'm pretty dorky and nerdy myself. But if somebody is being a projection of a character of who they want to be, and maybe it happens out of nervousness. I feel like I've probably done that in the past too, especially being shy, and insecurities usually bring that forth. But if somebody is not authentically being themselves, which sometimes is a reflection of lack of confidence. So maybe I could say that I'm more attracted to confidence, people that are confidently and whole within themselves and feel comfortable putting themselves forward. And for some people that takes time. But if somebody's not being authentic, it's kind of a turnoff for me. Certainly in relationships and just for in general, getting busy too. That's probably one of the biggest parts of why I'm slow to play is I want to get to know a person authentically. And I want however that is, even if we're just friends, and that's great. I want to have authentic friendships. And if intimacy happens, if I choose to make myself that vulnerable with someone, which is a wonderful, beautiful thing. And of course, as you might have already known, if you've listened to my past episodes, which for me usually means plural play and plural dating. So the more the merrier, right? But it needs to be authentic for me in order for it to really work for me. I'm not one to force it. So I completely relate to her draw to being authentic and having authentic connections. Also, she brings up, having people meet certain standards. I definitely have had experiences that have brought me to appreciate how important that is. And that's why I focus on the test of time. Like, I don't necessarily look for specific cues for every person, because certain clues that cue you into characteristics for one person are not going to be the same for the other. People are very complex and individual. And because I appreciate this, that's why I usually give the test of time and experience with people. That's kind of what time gives you, is it gives you experiences with people and exchanges that highlight and illuminate who they are, who they uniquely are, through those unique experiences. But I can certainly see how, especially based on my experience in my voyage through the Tinderverse of dating and online connections, if that's your primary source of finding people for polyamorous or for swinging, aka lifestyle connections, then yeah, I mean, it seems very impersonal and it can be complex, because now you're qualifying people based on written word or maybe what they've posted. No, there's a problem with here that I brought up in some later comments to this post. I definitely had a few things to say, and I'll share one of them in a minute. But one of the things I brought up was this episode of one of my shows that I watch every once in a while. That's really entertaining. It's a show called Adam Ruins Everything. it's really a good show. And he did one on internet dating, or on app dating, like Tinder, Bumble. I don't even know what all of them are anymore. I've been out of it for a few years. I was in it for a couple of years. It was an awful experience, or it was an interesting, illuminating experience for me, but not something I would go back to. And what he brings up in like match.com datings is that when you match people, even if you're doing it on your own, like through meeting through people on Facebook, by your compatibility, and by your personality traits, and oh, you're 100% perfect match because of your personality and compatibility traits. Well, that does not studies show, and he brings up in this show very, very well, he outlines it out, that does not show you attraction. That does not show you real compatibility. That only happens in person. It really does, in the nuance of body language and how you talk to each other, how the other person talks to you, like how that feels in the moment. Really, that's where attraction happens. It's kind of almost like a sixth sense we all have, in terms of, or even just like your pheromones, you know, like what natural perfumes, how they mix. Even that really, science shows us, comes into play too. And you cannot pick up any of these things on a dating app, on a quiz that you take on match.com where it matches you with a person. None of these things will really tell you who you're attracted to. And that's why, statistically speaking, they have such a high failure rate in terms of, I mean, the one good thing about them is that you'll meet a higher volume of people. So of course that makes sense, where if you're meeting a higher volume of people, that you'll eventually probably find somebody that you're attracted to, right? But can't we accomplish this in other ways, networking in other ways that feel more natural, less forced, with less presumptions? I really am a big believer that just getting out there and meeting people, and meeting people through friends, you know, is kind of the best way, to approach dating. Really, to just maybe not necessarily always focusing on meeting people in a bar. That cliche seems to to be attached to like making decisions when you're drunk, right? When you're not sober. So maybe not that approach, though that's not a bad approach either. With polyamory, I think that she brings up a really great point, because I think it's become really complex in this modern age where there's more and more people being polyamorous. And so the dating pool has a higher demand for meeting people. There's not that many social outings and connections like there is for the lifestyle for polyamory. And this is something I brought up later. I was like, it really would be nice if maybe more people from both groups could merge and be more social together, because we have a lot of commonalities. We have a lot of things in common. Or maybe polyamory can kind of do that on its own, have more like regional, like social gathering and networkings. And I really think that for this dating issue she brings up, with the advent of technology making it feel more impersonal, making it feel more like you're hiring somebody for a job, which takes all of the fun and excitement out of it. Let's be honest, all of it. I think it would really address that if we had more of these events and social gatherings and maybe clubs and things like that. Like the lifestyles, that's such a good example for sure. So the comment that I left initially for her was this, and I think it's, I'll read it and then I'll say another point on it. So go back to the drawing board. It sounds like it's time to rewrite your air quotes, how we fall in love story. Dating sites offer in-depth analysis of our personalities to match us with the perfect partner or partners based on compatibility comparisons. The truth is that nothing can really replace the magic that happens in the nuance within in-person encounters. One of my favorite episodes of Adam Ruins Everything covers this. Dating based on data quickly gets stale. It's far more important to engage each other organically. So let me know what you think about that. I thought it was a really interesting point that she brought up from somebody who's been in polyamory for a while, and an issue that she's noticed with, you know, networking. And maybe she didn't come around and say that, but that's really what it screamed to me, was that. Because it makes sense. You know, we want a plural format in a relationship. We want to meet people. How do we do that? And how do we do that in a way where we're not relying on technology, where it feels so impersonal? So these next questions came to me from Instagram. And this asker said, when you are dating in poly, different people, is there things that you in general like about people, or do you just go by how you feel? For example, my girlfriend's into hairy guys. So like, is that what you look for in all men because you are poly, or do you just see and how you feel with each person? Okay, so I think the question there is like, for guys, do I always go for a specific type of guy? And for girls, do I always go for a specific type of girl? And then he asks, or do you sometimes compensate for what you miss in some people by having it in other people? So for me, I actually have a really, like, my attraction aesthetic is really like a rainbow. The one thing that I used to have a lot more preferences than I do now. I have a lot fewer when it comes to aesthetic. For me, it's mainly about just the person, really. For a while, I was really anti-facial hair. Like, I hated facial hair. And primarily it was because it bugs me when it's not groomed. So like, I have like a lot of little pet peeves, but for that, it's something that I would, not that I don't like changing people, but if I was dating a guy and he had facial hair and he wasn't keeping it well groomed and clean and trimmed, then I would offer to help him with that. I've helped past boyfriends in the past with that, keeping them their beards and mustaches trimmed, especially the mustache. Like, I don't like the lip, like, I don't know. I'm a little bit OCD and anal about it. But most men that I've encountered that have, you know, like facial hair are pretty good at manscaping and keeping it and tidy and let me help. So that's not really been an issue for me anymore than it was when I first started dating. But for men and women, so races, like I date all races. I don't have an aesthetic preference there. But really, I think for men, I guess I would say, and this is assuming gender binary. So that's like traditional female, traditional male. So I tend to gravitate toward men that are just in the style of dressing, kind of like a traditional style of dress, I suppose. But that can really vary too. And then for women, I guess more traditionally feminine, effeminate sort of presentation aesthetically. But really for me, like easygoing people, it's really more about personality for me that are kind of usually turn-ons and turned-offs for whether or not initially based on first impressions. Like if I meet somebody and they seem extra negative, or if they seem, here's one thing that really bugs me, judgmental people. Like I really cannot hang out with that. I'm very tolerant and open-minded, and I really really turned off by somebody that looks at other people and judges and that tries to oppressively fit other people into the box. Like when I'm dating somebody and they say something like, oh, well, we're attractive and we're not going to hang out with those people because they're unattractive. And that's actually pretty present in the lifestyle. And I usually am not very attracted to that. So it seems like some really hot people in the lifestyle have said things like that to me. And honestly, when I've heard that, I've kind of crossed them off my list. I don't care how hot you are. If you're calling yourself the hot person and you're not going to like hang out with or let the other people that you have deemed like the unattractive people hang out with you, then you're already a no for me, for sure. Like, it's just such a huge turnoff for me. So that's like more of a personality-based thing, for sure. But I know women and men have certain specific aesthetics. Like I'm a curvy girl. I guess with women, I tend to gravitate more toward curvy women, but there's been women that are more lean that I've also been very attracted to. So yeah, so I guess variety is the spice of my life. So I really mixed it up there, I guess, to answer that question, sort of. But your next piece of your question really reminded me of something. So I think it was kind of suggesting like, okay, so if you're looking, you know, if your partner doesn't have this, are you able through polyamory to have somebody else compensate for that? And then for me, I guess that would definitely be true when it comes to the power play. Not every man, I like power play with or have experienced it more than with men. I'm sure I would like it with women too. I've had moments of hints of it with women, but women with women, I don't know. It's just hasn't been as much in my experience. But like if I was dating a man and he wasn't really into power play and we were dating and it was amazing, then that's great. And that's not broken. I'm not going to try to fix it, right? But the beautiful thing about polyamory for me is that I would be open to being able to connect with the dom and having a dom in addition to keeping that person in my life. So yes, for me and a lot of people, that's actually a very, very great opportunity is that, you know, if you're with a partner and you're into a specific fetish or kink, and it's not their thing, it doesn't come to them naturally, what polyamory or open relationships or ethical non-monogamy of really any type offers you is the opportunity to connect with others and intimately and or in relationship, depending on your brand of ethical non-monogamy. It allows you that opportunity to still have to keep your lover and still maintain that relationship and nurture it and be within it, but then also get that extra something from somebody else that's not right for that partner. Taking one for the team is never really works. You know, being open to considering something in the future that our partner really is drawn to is a beautiful thing. But if it's not genuinely you, you should never take one for the team. You need to, within your own sexual experience, be authentic to yourself as well. It's a partnership, and so it's got to be right for all partners. And so it's really important that we're always doing that. And that's really what's great about having plural partners or just plural dating, plural format of play, whatever it is right for you, is that it offers the opportunity to experience your fetish with somebody that it's right for when the person that you're already with, it's not right for them. So great questions. Thank you so much. So if you tuned in to my episode on vaginas, one of my favorite episodes of sexploration to date, I can hardly wait to do the episode on penises. Maybe I'll do that this week. I'll see if I can get that done. I talked about squirting and that I'm a squirter. And what I've heard from a lot of sexologists and, you know, I listen to podcasts all the time is that squirting, it's not urine. It's prostate fluid, you know. So that's what I shared with you is based on that knowledge from people that I consider, you know, experienced. And that's kind of what's out there in the buzz is like, oh no, it's not urine, it's not pee, it's prostate fluid. Well, I got an update from a listener who's a doctor. So this doctor really knows. So I wanted to share it with you because I thought it was really important to have the right information. I like to have the right information. So if I get a correction, I want to share it with you. And the after chat, I mean, that's the perfect place for it, right? So one of my listeners says, as a medical professional and having done over 1,000 pelvic surgeries, I do disagree with you about squirting. So he says, the gland in a woman that produces the fluid for their ejaculate is at the largest, the size of a green pea. There is no physical, I love that because my little bag of peas is how I ice my vagina. Sorry, that's so that I thought was appropriate. But it's the size of a green pea at the largest, but usually smaller. There's no physical possibility for a gland that size to produce and store and excrete the amount of fluid that that I produce when I squirt, and that a lot of women that produce a lot of squirting fluid do. So that's roughly about 500 milliliters is about what a gland that size could produce. A prostate in the peak health can only produce roughly about 2 tablespoons of fluid, or about 60 milliliters. So that's a man. Is that a prostate of a woman? Anyways, I think that would be a man, right? So at leak health or at peak health, the prostate is the size of a walnut. And the excretions expelled by the typical female in the lifestyle or in porn videos and the majority is majority made up of bladder contents. So I thought this was so interesting. So it is pee. It's totally pee. I mean, you know, that's why I have a blanket, right? to keep the mattress safe, right? So I guess it is more like golden showers than I thought. So I wanted to share that from you. So I said, thank you so much. That's so interesting. I'd heard different over these years from sex experts, but I tend to agree with your expert opinion. Of course, it's a doctor. Of course, he would know. So I asked him, so why do some women squirt so much more than others? And then also, how can I pee right after squirting? And I do. I pee right before sex and after. It's one of my rituals. And so I said, sorry if that's too much to ask. I wanted to take advantage of your expert opinion while I had your attention. And then I also asked if Kegels will genuinely, which is what I've always heard, help prevent uterine prolapse. So I've heard that slow sex lives can lead to weaknesses in the vaginal wall of muscles. So that's like if you are having sex once a month, I've heard that it can really cause those muscles to lose their strength and cause other issues within the female anatomy. So he said it's a great topic to discuss. So during orgasm, sometimes even when we fake orgasms, a woman will ejaculate and add urine, much like a man will. So some is urine and some is ejaculate, a different ratio depending on every person for sure. Peeing afterwards can be done because there is still residual urine in the bladder, and the increased heart rate and blood pressure during sexual activity forces more filtration in the kidneys and produces more urine. Kegels, do a ton of Kegels. Uterine prolapse is definitely is a definite future problem that a lot of women face. Kegels strengthen the sacroiliac ligament. Let's say that again, sacroiliac ligament. I hope I got that right in the first try. So that ligament helps suspend the uterus and the bladder in the pelvic cavity. And this definitely reduces Kegels, the risk of prolapse, as well as the sphincter, which holds in the urine in the bladder, reducing the risk of urinary incontinence when like laughing or you're sneezing or crying, etc. So Kegels will also strengthen the anal sphincter. So I'm so glad that you shared that. Thank you so much. I know that was super doctory and sciencey, but I thought that was a great, great information to share because there's a lot of information out there that misled me and kind of led me down the wrong path. So I think it's really important that we have experts out there. If you're an expert and you ever hear anything, please do share because I want to make sure that I'm sharing the right information and that I myself have the right information. So thank you so much for reaching out. And again, if you are an expert and you hear anything along the way that you want to add your expert experience to, please do share with me, and we'll be sure to include it on one of the episodes in the after chat. So I wanted to share a message I got from actually before I started my podcast. There's a little bit more to it, but we'll start with his first question. His first question was, how long have you been into poly? Well, I heard about polyamory as my divorce was finalizing in 2014. It was the first time I'd ever heard about a specific form of ethical non-monogamy. I'm sure I'd heard about swingers before, but just kind of the old cliche, or something I never considered because it was, you know, so taboo and so, you know, raunchy and under the radar and so, you know, apart from anything I would ever know. So I found out about polyamory from watching a show on Showtime called Polyamory, Married and Dating, and really felt called to it, was drawn to learn more about it, and did. So that was in 2014. And I would say about the end of 2015, when I had been dating for a while, I took a year off after my divorce was final to just kind of do the eat, pray, love thing and focus on me. And then the year after it was final, I started getting into dating again. And it wasn't right away when I started dating that I approached and embraced polyamory, but I'd already been thinking about it. But it kind of, you know, occurred to me, like, you know, this is something I really want to try and it's important to me. So I did. So it was like the end of 2015, maybe mid, that I was starting to talk about it, being open to it. But it wasn't until really 2016 that I started employing it and saying, yes, this is what I want and this is how I want to go moving forward, and started actually dating polyamorously. So almost about 4 years now, about three years really, into being polyamorous and dating polyamorously and dating plurally. So he says, it intrigues me, but our backgrounds appear to be similar. My wife and I are in the lifestyle and very sex positive, but my wife doesn't want to be poly. We came really close to having a poly relationship with another woman, but it almost killed our marriage. So my wife has come a long way into being comfortable with the lifestyle, and I'm hoping one day she's comfortable with polyamory, but I would never push her for that. So that's the second part, and I'll get to the third part of this question in a minute. So I think that's a really excellent approach, and I have to highlight and applaud you for this. Your wife knows about polyamory. It's something you considered in the past. It wasn't the right fit then. You hope for it in the future, but you love her, you cherish her, you would never push her for more. You're active and swinging, so you already have a form of ethical non-monogamy that you're successfully pursuing with each other. It's important to grow with your partner, and if it takes time, it takes time. And, you know, some people do have to make that choice of, I need to be polyamorous. This is who I am, and my partner can't meet me at the same level. And so for some people, it comes to the point where it's a decision, well, I love you, but you're not letting me be myself. So that is a possibility that some people do face in the future. It doesn't really sound that's where he's at. So I really have to applaud you for cherishing and treasuring what you have, being respectful of it, being patient with it. But if that is kind of a reality too, where a lot of people do have to end up making that choice, this is who I am and I can't be with my partner as much as I love them because it's more important for me to be myself. So some people do reach that crossroads for sure. Sounds like that's not where he's at. But it's a tough choice some people do end up having to make. Especially if it's that important to you. For me, that polyamory is so intrinsically who I am, just like me being bisexual is so intrinsically who I am. I couldn't be with a partner who wouldn't allow me to be polyamorous and bisexual and have both intrinsic callings be met with some end. So that's me. That's my answer. But that's not necessarily the answer for anyone. You have to know that within yourself and ask yourself those questions. So I wanted to share that because I think he really brings up a great perspective there, that from what he wants and desires, but also what he's experiencing now in his love and in his life. So then he asks about, I don't really understand the cisgender thing. Can you give me some insight? Why do you use another name for the original name given of the original two genders? Great question. And I love how you're approaching this with wanting to understand. So I did a post on this in the past saying, I'm a cisgendered woman. And what that means is that I was born anatomically a woman and I remain anatomically and the way I live my life and my gender of choice, a woman. So people that are transgender females were not anatomically born women. Right? So they were not born a woman, but they become a woman. So when I say I'm cisgendered, what that's basically doing is acknowledging and respecting that a woman who was not anatomically born a woman is as much a woman in my heart and in my esteem as I am. So it's a sign of respect and endearment and inclusion. And it's very important that we change our language in this way to be more inclusive. So that's kind of why it's important to me, is because it's important for me to be inclusive. And it's important for transgender people, for allies of those that are transgender, to be inclusive. And the differentiation is important to me. And so that's why I use that terminology. Some people are really, we all grew up and we still exist within a gender, what's called a gender binary world. So gender binary is saying that there's only man and woman, and it doesn't matter if you're transgender for a lot of people's esteems. Like you're either a man or a woman, and there's this black and white. I've had several discussions with my very conservative father on this, and he really, really struggles and is not interested in continuing the conversation further, and which is his prerogative. But that's kind of the issue, though, really, is that when we're trying to peg people into these holes and they don't necessarily fit, we're not really representing them compassionately. We're not being, frankly, loving to them in a way that we could and should be. So, so there's this thought called in, what is it? Philosophy. It's called postmodern thought, where basically suggests that everything we know of as gender, even in like, if you look at, there's an episode on Joe Rogan where he gives the example, on Joe Rogan's podcast, where his guest gives the example of dogs. Like, what is a dog? We just decided this animal was dog, and there's all these breeds of dog, and we decided that all these breeds of dogs are all dogs, and it's just a category of dog we created. And that it's kind of the same thing with gender. We just decided that, anatomically speaking, that if you seem to have these characteristics, you're female. And if you seem to have these characteristics, you're male. And then you're caught within all the social pressures and norms within these two binary categories. You know, just like cats and dogs are binarily categorized, men and women are binarily categorized. And so postmodern thoughts challenging this and saying that this is only legitimate because we've decided collectively it's legitimate really paved the way for the transgender movement to have freedom to grow, to have freedom to say, hey, we get to choose our gender. And society doesn't get to tell us this. As we're called to, we get to choose our gender. Well, still, I see how people kind of get confused with this, because if you're choosing a gender, you're differentiating, right? So you're choosing male or female. It's still within the constructs. So I certainly understand how people really struggle with this, because it's not cut and dry now, is it? And we're trying to understand it logically and compassionately at the same time. The key, I think, is important to be to seek understanding together, collectively, collaboratively, and to be compassionate throughout the whole process. Be patient with people, right? Just it's that simple. Be patient with people. If we've grown up in these like very, you know, black and white categorizations of who we are as people, we have to give people time to think a little bit more complexly, to think more dynamically, to think with more freedom. So it's certainly is something that I completely, I think that your question is legitimate. I'm not offended by it. I think it's an excellent question. So I say I'm cisgender to be more inclusive. And it also expresses that to me, freedom is key. Sexual freedom, freedom of gender identity, freedom of preferences when it comes to sexuality and life. There should be more freedom there. And it shouldn't be necessarily, you know, you have to fit into these categories. What I'm saying is make your own category. And I think that me saying that I'm a cisgendered woman is one of many excellent ways that I can express that. So last week, if you tuned in, I did a really quick episode on toxic masculinity. And then I also did a blog post to kind of elaborate on some of the points I made during that show. So the blog post elicited some comments. So I thought I'd read the blog post to you today and then the comments that came from that. If you find toxic masculinity offensive, it's probably because you haven't heard a good explanation, because to say it applies to all men is absurd and irresponsible. It's a concept that basically says society puts pressure on men to be a certain archetype of a man. My argument, and the argument of others, is that men are whole beings, capable of being so much more than those limits, and they often are. The problem toxic masculinity highlights is that some men are affected by this, and those are the bad seeds, like the rapists and the violent abusers, for example. Other men are the keys to keeping men like this in check, but women bear responsibility too. When women say things like, if you are a real man, they debase and undermine all men. And here, so I included some videos that were, and also in the podcast, that were good to watch to kind of have explanations of the arguments to this to that effect. And then I said, let's be honest, the word choice here, toxic masculinity, is harsh within and of itself. It doesn't sit well with most. It's a highly negative word pair attributed to men specifically. And I get it. I assumed that this was intentional, probably just to get the most attention. That's what buzzwords do, right? There is likely toxic femininity equivalent if we really thought about it. I don't think that it's an attack on all masculinity, but being based in postmodern thought, its word selection is more of an attack of gender binary itself. I feel if we continue to have intelligent, considerate conversations exchanged with respect and understanding, these flash buzzword waves and viral hashtags will evolve from a virtual gender war into a united and unified front of betterment. And so I had a poster that said, wow, great post. And I said, thank you. He said, I've been trying to put my thoughts into words, but often people were offended, as well as how the term itself is antagonistic. But now I don't have to, and that's awesome. So what he did is he shared my post. And I said to him, great new thoughts turn into a gender war. We all lose. It's so important for all to understand in a way that connects everyone. With humility, always. We improve in society and culture as allies. As enemies, we regress. So his response was, I agree absolutely. I think it's important that we put good things into the world. People can quickly revert to the very basic us versus them tribalism and focus on win versus a beneficial holistic outcome. As someone who is also trying to put love, respect, encouragement, empowerment into the world, I definitely appreciate you putting yourself out there. And I said, my pleasure. It's always my pleasure. So thank you so much for your comments on that. I am so grateful. So I had to share this comment from some of my friends, Charlie and Arian. They commented on a post that I did promoting my Toxic Masculinity podcast that we just talked about. And this is what they said. We were asked today if we've ever met you in person by someone who listens to your podcast. And we said no. That's something we need to fix soon, guys. And this person quickly lost interest in what we had to say. LOL. Keep doing what you're doing, girl. People are listening. Hashtag positive energy. And I said, that's amazing. So they were in Cancun at Desire. At an event there. I think it's National Swingers Month. And so they have a bunch of guests coming in. I was there last year in January. It's an amazing resort. I cannot recommend it enough. So to have somebody all the way from Cancun ask them about me, I was just so humbled, and it just brought light to my day. So thank you so much. Whoever you are, please reach out to me so that I can say hi, because I really appreciate you listening in. And I do have to say, Charlie and Arian are great to talk with, and you'll always gain from a conversation with them. They actually have a ton of videos out there. Check out their page. I'll try to leave a link to that in my show details too, so you can check them out. They have a lot of experience in psychology. They're just really good people, and in sex subculture. And so they talk about real issues that we all face. It's relatable really to anyone, but their videos are really excellent little bites of just gems, gold knowledge that we can all take with us, learn, and grow from. So that kind of brings us to the end of the show today. I know this was supposed to come out on Thursday. I'm so sorry. Last week was so busy, but better late than never, right? And I didn't want to skip this show at all because it is the one that is by far most well-received, that you all seem to really cherish, respond to, and treasure it the most. So I had to do it, albeit on Monday, but hey, better late than never, right? So the after chat this week will be on Thursday. I'll post it in the morning because I'm about to go on a trip with some of my dearest friends. I just adore them. I cannot wait to spend a few days with them. And so that will be a trip to Utah. Very exciting. So I'll be traveling on Thursday late morning. So I'll be posting the after chat probably early in the morning so that you should still get that this week. So I am asking for a little bit of your help here. I'm trying a new recording program to see how it goes, but I'm wondering how it sounds on your end, how it's working for you on your devices. So please do. This is my request for a report back to me on the audio quality or anything else with the audio. On how this program is working. I've been using Audacity, in case you're curious, but this is a new program within my RSS feed that I wanted to give a try to see how it felt in terms of pace and in terms of sound. So please do let me know, like volume, quality, how it compares, and what your thoughts are. I would really appreciate it. Did you like this episode? Be sure and let me know. Like, rate, review, and subscribe. Be sure you also check out my website, sexplorationwithpoe.wixsite.com/website. In the details of every show, I leave a link right there for you. If you look at the top right corner of the website, you'll find my page, Where to Listen. That's got a link to all of the platforms my podcast is on. Really quick and easy way to share the show with your friends. As always, be good to yourself and be good to others. Laters.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.